In a small town like Grace, something as simple as a teenage party around a bonfire could become elevated to a revered annual event. That was the Bonfire Blowout Bash, a night when memories were forged and lives forever changed, be that for better or worse. Like many other small towns, Grace offered very little for the young people, besides sneaking beers and exploring burgeoning sexualities. So it was, so it had always been. To wit, just a quarter mile up the hill outside of Grace was a well-worn clearing in the middle of the woods. It had been used as a make-out spot traditionally, going back decades. But one night every year it hosted a big party. Tonight was that party. The local kids started arriving just after dark, and by 10 p.m., the joint was jumping. The clearing was damn near full. People had to park in neat rows just to fit everyone in. And for once, tonight people didn't stay inside their cars. Almost everyone brought some wood to burn and cheap beer or cigars or wine to pass around. Some people brought lawn chairs, and others found fallen logs to perch on as everyone gathered around the blackened fire pit in the center of the clearing and watched that massive bonfire grow and grow. A full moon, a raging fire, a license given to the youth of Grace to act a fool. Magical things could happen on nights like this. There must have been upwards of 50 young people there, which, for context, in this neck of the woods, was like goddamn Woodstock. Not too far away from the fire, but not too close. Sitting along an old felled tree was Marla Cole, passing a bottle of wine around with her friends. Marla was on her first date with Tom, a nervous fella who had been pussyfooting around her for the last couple of years. Further on down the log was Marla's BFF, Heather, and her boyfriend, Bo. Heather and Bo were truly in the spirit of the evening and making out with the reckless abandon and lack of proper fear of cold sores that only teenagers possess. Tom and Marla, on the other hand, not so much. Tom was not a make-the-first-move type of guy. And to be fair, for her part, Marla had a very unique position within their friend group. Being the daughter of the sheriff, Marla was afforded a different kind of respect than most girls her age got. Well, and with that in mind, Tom was not about to chug beers and get handsy with Marla Cole. Seizing the initiative, Marla grabbed Tom by the hand and led him away from the clearing and out into the woods. Like Tom, Marla was a reserved young person. Going out into the woods, this wasn't about doing anything. She wasn't about to give it up on a night like this out in the woods like a goddamn permanent townie. That was not Marla Cole's style. But she did want to get to know Tom a little better. And so a quiet walk in the woods sounded like a good place to start. So they walked and they talked. But before long, they heard something odd. They heard the sound of a little girl crying. They found her standing next to a big oak tree. She was holding her face in her hands and sobbing. Tom went to her. He got down on one knee in front of her and he tried to calm her down. The girl said her name was Emily and that she'd gotten lost from her parents. Tom introduced Marla and said that her daddy was the sheriff and he was going to help Emily. Oh, the girl smiled big at that. She gave Tom a big hug and asked him for one more favor. Well, of course, honey, what can I do? She says, will you tell me what it feels like to bleed to death? In her hand was a long, thin blade, and she plunged it with expert precision into the femoral artery at the top of his thigh. Blood geysered out of it in hot streams, splashing the leaves on the ground. Emily explained to Tom that there was no way to stop the bleeding in such a wound, and that he would lose consciousness and die within 30 to 45 seconds. And then she giggled. Tom collapsed. Marla screamed. And Emily turned the bloody blade on her. "You're next. Off with her head." Marla ran for help. She ran back towards the clearing. By the time she got there, it was already too late. The other devils had arrived, and the Night of the Long Knives was well underway. Drinking whiskey in the kitchen and telling scary stories around the fire. Music, monsters, and mayhem, killers, cannibals, and cults, fearful fiction and furious fact, tall tales, and terrible truths. This is A Scary Home Companion. This is the story of Marla Cole and what happened to her on the Night of the Long Knives. At this moment, standing on the edge of the clearing, Marla was paralyzed with fear. And normally, she was a very confident, very self-assured young woman. She had been raised by a stern single father who had forced her to believe in herself. And so, Marla never hesitated to raise her voice or her hands in her own defense. And yet, here, now, there was nothing that she could do. She was trapped, powerless, watching unspeakable mayhem and carnage unfolding in the clearing before her. There were bodies everywhere. There were more bodies falling by the heartbeat. And not just bodies. These were friends. These were familiar faces. These were teenagers that she went to school with, dying by the handful. Ben Burroughs, the deformed giant, was snapping people in half and tossing them into the bonfire like cordwood. Obadiah Moncrief, the bearded cannibal hillbilly, savagely broke a young man's neck and dragged his screaming girlfriend away into the woods. From the sound of the cries, Marla could tell that girlfriend was her friend Heather. The monster called Razormouth was running amok down the line of cars, jumping from hood to hood and slicing and slashing all the way. His hands were needle talons, his face a gaping maw of bloody shards, and it feasted upon the meat of the young like a shark, not killing for food or sustenance, killing out of pure, murderous nature. The smell of meat cooking assailed her, and when Marla realized that she was smelling her own friends roasting over an open flame, she turned and vomited. And that vomit might have actually saved her life. Emily was approaching from behind and trying so hard to be stealthy, but when she saw Marla puke, it made her giggle. Marla was scared and trembling, but now that she saw this kid, she was ready to fight. It was just a goddamn kid, so she picked up a hefty tree branch and swung it at the knife-wielding child, who scattered and started calling out, "Benji! Benji! Help!" The giant by the bonfire, who still held a bleeding teenage boy in his hands, heard the call and looked squarely at Marla. She dropped that branch and she ran. Marla was a runner, a long-distance runner for the high school track team. She'd practice in this terrain, so even in the forest and the rough land at night, she knew she could get to her father at the police substation in just a few minutes. He would have guns, and he would be able to call for real help. Emily commanded Ben to come to her and pick her up. Follow her, she commanded. She's going to take us right to the sheriff. When the monsters had emerged from the woods, at first Heather and Bo were too deeply involved in making out to look up, but then the yelling quickly turned into screaming, and they saw that all hell had broken loose, and the foulest devils had come for them. The cannibal hog farmer made eyes for Heather, and he waddled as he ran towards her. He was much faster than he looked. He grabbed Bo by the head and twisted it around until his neck popped and his bowels released. And then he grabbed Heather, and he started dragging her into the woods. She spun, and she pulled, and she clawed, and she scratched, and she bit. And finally, she managed to pull away and start to crawl off. A pair of blood-spattered girls ran right in front of her, and Heather called out for help, but they either couldn't or wouldn't hear her. Finally, she got her feet squarely under her. The bearded hillbilly was shouting, chasing her, but she sprinted away on bare feet, not daring to look back. She plunged into the brush in the woods, and after 100 yards, it broke way, and Heather emerged on one of the many old dirt roads that crisscrossed the valley. Just a few feet away, she saw that there was a young man kneeling in the dirt. He was shaking in fear and weeping, asking for help. Heather didn't recognize the boy, but she knew he wasn't one of them. "What's happening?" she asked him. She touched his shoulder. "What's going on? What are these things?" The young man looked up at her, and suddenly he got a very angry look on his face. "Are you looking at my man, whore?" he snarled. The lovers attacked Heather with a barrage of lust-fueled thrusts to the face and neck with a pair of butcher's knives. The lovers were so wrapped up in overkilling poor Heather that they didn't notice Marla emerging from the forest just down the road. Marla saw what was happening to her friend and she stifled a cry. She turned around. She kept running. Grace was a sprawling community, but still a small one. Marla kept her head down, her legs pumping. She focused on controlling her breathing, and she ran hard. Past a few houses, she could name who lived there in every one. Then the church. She broke left at the hardware store. She knew Mrs. Holka was there that night. They were doing inventory, and Miss Holka had more than one gun. But Marla couldn't afford to stop. She had to get to see her dad. And when she got there, she got to the door of the cop shop. She looked through. She saw her dad sitting behind his tiny desk, punching away at the phone, trying to figure out the voicemail. He could never figure out the voicemail. When she saw that, and then when he saw her, and that aching look of concern clouded his face, Marla lost it. The fear, the shock, the adrenaline, the intensity, the delayed impact of seeing all of her friends slaughtered. It came down on her all at once like an avalanche, and she collapsed, sobbing into her father's arms. He led her across the room. He sat her down behind the little desk. He took off his coat and draped it over her heaving shoulders, and he tried to get her to calm down and talk. So many words were all pouring out at once, but she could tell by the look on his face he wasn't able to make sense of it. But how could he? It didn't make any sense. "You have to just calm down," he said. "Tell me what happened so I can call the Stadies and call in reinforcements. Just hold on. Who's that? Is she with you?" Sheriff Cole looked up and saw young Emily Mason standing just outside his front door, waving to him. He was embracing his daughter, and Marla's face was pressed up against his chest, so she didn't see the girl. When the sheriff saw the blood on Emily's hands, he was startled, and he ran for the door. And he was already there. He was already pushing it open. He was already kneeling down before Marla saw what was happening and saw who was at the door. Sheriff Cole talked to Emily. Marla called out to him, and so he turned his head to look at her. And that's when Emily reached up and slit his throat from ear to ear. Ben reached in and grabbed the top of the sheriff's head, palming it like a basketball, and twisted it 180 degrees. The sheriff fell. He hit the floor on his back and his face. Marla shrieked. She crawled across the floor to him, throwing her body over his and hugging him tightly. Ben and Emily entered the police station. She locked the door behind them. She gloated about how they were going to come and find the police anyway. But there was a pretty dolly who led them right to where they needed to be. So they got to kill the law, and now it was time to play with Marla. All around Grace, the monsters began to hunt. Outside of town, Gordo the clown did a little soft shoe routine as he walked down the dusty trail. The thing you need to understand about Gordo is that he was always on. On stage, on camera, at home, in the crawl space, in the middle of the forest, alone, with people, it didn't matter. There was no Gordon Jones anymore. There was only Gordo. Gordo was missing his face. He was lonely. He was aimless without his face. But still, he coached his way through it. He lit up the applause sign for himself. He practiced new material. He polished old material. He laughed at his own jokes. He sang his theme song. He loved his theme song. And then he almost tripped over the body of Heather without noticing it. There was not a whole lot left of poor Heather above her collarbones. Tisk, 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 Gordo tisked. It looks like you flirted with Eric. The body still had a small purse laying on the ground next to it. With bated breath and crossed fingers and toes, Gordo opened it up. And he found a couple of useless things, like money and a cell phone. But then, there it was, bingo, bango, some lipstick and a compact. Finally, Gordo could put his face on.
Hello, no one is available to take your call. Please leave a message after the tone.
Hey, Sheriff. I heard some noise from over the bonfire right down the way. Not the kind you expect, neither. Not like, you know, not a good hooting and hollering. It's, you should check it out, probably. Sooner's better than later.
Not far from there, an increasingly hungry Obadiah Moncrief made a beeline through the woods. There were two very clear scents that had caught his delicate sniffer: the cooking of bacon and cheap waitress perfume. After his inability to land a wriggling fish, so to speak, at the bonfire, he was hungry in more than one way. He blamed that, by the way, on Razormouth for killing so many of those kids so quickly before a guy like Obi could claim his fair share. All that was in the rear view because Obi had found the Grace Diner. It was a very small building next to a double-wide trailer. Through the front glass, he could see a big, beefy short-order cook and a smaller but still beefy waitress. Lots of meat on the hoof. Just Obi's style. Obi went inside and he locked the door behind him.
Hello, no one is available to take your call. Please leave a message after the tone.
I was just heading back from town and I noticed there seems to be a hitchhiker out near Suicide Bridge. I did not like the look of him.
At the same time, the machinist had finished his slow-driving recon of the Valley of Grace and parked his car in front of the hardware store. There were lights on inside and two other cars parked out back. This pleased the machinist, and while others might have ascribed this to luck, the machinist did not believe in luck. He believed in destiny. That he had found not only a store with the tools and machines he desired, but also the unwilling victims on hand that he could use these tools and machines on. This seemed predestined to the machinist. He let himself in the unlocked back door, and he got to work. Oh, how he had missed his work.
Hello, no one is available to take your call. Please leave a message after the tone.
Jim, hey Jim, sorry, this is Gene. I don't know how to say this, but I think I just saw a monster.
Marla was still sprawled out on top of her father's body, but she was no longer crying. Now she was trying to get her breath back under control. She couldn't run, she couldn't fight, she couldn't even talk or scream for help until she found her breath. Ben grunted and squealed at Emily, who finally sighed and relented and agreed that, okay, Ben, you can have her. I need to do some other stuff anyway, but don't you break that dolly before I can play with her too. Emily went over to the sheriff's desk, and she started looking through the drawers and the files. It only took her a couple of minutes before she had learned everything that she wanted to learn about Grace. She knew that the dead cop was the only real cop in the valley, and that his only backup was a part-time weekend deputy who was a retiree from Detroit named Andre Montgomery. She decided it would probably be a good idea to call in Andre. Emily was very fond of removing every possible variable from every possible equation, and she wanted a full night left completely uninterrupted to play with her new dollies. Ben kneeled down next to Marla, and he touched her shoulder. At first, it felt like he was patting her, comforting her maybe. But then he grabbed her roughly and he turned her around. By this time, Marla had found her breath. And somewhat more importantly, she had also found the revolver in her father's belt. She aimed the gun at Ben. He grabbed at it and she shot him through the palm. Blam. A huge chunk of meat and his two smallest fingers went flying across the room. Ben screeched and held his hand up to his face, staring at it in disbelief, staring through it at Emily in disbelief. Benji, poor Benji, Emily shouted. Marla crawled past him, slipped by him, and ran for the door. It was locked. Her fingers were still slick with her father's blood, and they scrabbled against the deadbolt. Emily commanded Ben to grab Marla, so he put his pain aside and he stomped across the room towards her. But finally, click, she got it. She threw the door open and she started running up the street. The gun was in her hand, but she didn't know if it would be enough against a monster like that. She needed to get to see Mrs. Hulka. She needed to get to the hardware store. She hadn't gotten very far before she heard something moving in the brush beside her. Something was matching her movements, stalking her as she ran down the road. She peered into the tree. She caught a glimpse of it moving in the moonlight, that deformed demon man that had been at the bonfire. Razormouth was here now, and it was watching her. Marla took a wild shot, trying to scare it off, but she didn't want to stop running to look closely. She didn't want to waste more bullets shooting aimlessly, so she kept running. She kept watching the bushes. She kept the gun up, waiting for the monster to come back. And it was still out there. She could hear the saliva-coated mirror shards grinding together hungrily. She got to the front door of the hardware store. She pounded on it, afraid to look away from the woods. And she saw it out there again. She sighted down the barrel. She heard that front door unlock, but she didn't want to turn away from the woods, and she didn't look to see who was standing there. She never knew that it was the machinist until he already had her. Fortunately for Marla, the machinist was not interested in killing her. Unfortunately for Marla, he was interested in seeing how long he could keep her alive. Poor Marla. Elsewhere, as the clock was just striking 11, Janice Dent called in all seven of the little girls from the backyard. They grabbed their croquet mallets and their wickets. Each girl took their colored ball, and they came inside without too much grumbling. This was Franny Dent's 12th birthday, and so Janice was waiving all the house rules. Next up, they were going to call a pizza shack and order a couple of pies and maybe even some breadsticks. They all debated back and forth of what to order off that menu. Outside, unbeknownst to them, Gordo the Clown peered in, watching them. He looked at the members of the slumber party, and a long streamer of drool fell from the tip of his chin as he debated what to order off the menu. Num, num, num. Thanks for listening to another episode of A Scary Home Companion, Night of the Long Knives, Part 2. Send feedback to the show to ascaryhomecompanion@gmail.com, or find me on Facebook. On Twitter, I am under the handle NateFlix. Subscribe to the show via Buzzsprout, iTunes, or by clicking that little heart on Spotify. And please, if you have something to say, write a review on your favorite reviewing platform. Music this week provided by Movie Theater with Into the Woods, Delyrics, Demon of the Night, Matt Siekel with Raven's Call and Holding Hands, Big Dan and the Lily Boys with the Gordo theme, Lee Rosevere, Orchestral Tortures, Kumquat, Everyone is Afraid of Clowns, and, as always, Chelsea Oxendine with the theme music. This episode was edited and produced by Bobo Belobo, the One-Eyed Hobo. Join me next week when I come at you with Night of the Long Knives, Part 3.